Welcome. Namaste. Thank you for joining us again this evening. We continue in Chapter 6 of the Mother, Sri Aurobindo's mighty book, brief though it is. There's an immemorial tradition, as we were saying, in India, which is still alive, unique in the countries of the world, where the worship of the Divine Mother is active, ongoing, unbroken probably for millenniums. We know that the goddess tradition around the world held sway for thousands of years in the earliest portion of human civilization, all the way up to, let's say, the Iron Age. Somewhere in that vicinity, we began to see dominant patriarchal societies, displaced matrilineal societies, and the worship of the goddess be pushed to the side. But in India, it continued, especially in rural areas, away from seats of power, centers of government, centers of commerce. The worship of the Divine Mother never altered, never faltered. We begin to see the living tradition of the goddess enter into Indian thinking and culture in a direct way that we can trace historically as it becomes Sanskritized. And the Sanskritization we see manifested first in the Markandeya Purana. A famous section of it is called the Devi Mahatmyam. We mentioned it last time. It's probably composed by 500 CE, roughly. Later, some of the themes elaborated there are taken still farther in the Devi Bhagavata Purana, roughly 500 years later, let's say. And almost contemporaneous with that, we see an effusion in the Tantric tradition in fine efflorescence in the Sri Lalita Sahasranama, the thousand names of the Divine Mother, which is part and parcel of the Sri Vidya tradition, which comes out of the Sri Kula older traditions, tracing its way all the way back to the beginning of Tantra, wherever that takes us. A somewhat frustrating historical analysis because it disappears into the mists of time. We don't know how old the Tantra is. Indian philosophy, of course, was well established centuries before the goddess tradition appears in Sanskrit. So we have great schools like the Sankhya school of philosophy. We have Advaita Vedanta. When we look at the Sankhya school, we find a language there that is used throughout the rest of Indian philosophy, even by Sri Aurobindo. That language, of course, refers to Purusha and Prakriti. Purusha is that witness consciousness, that reality of the soul, of the true person, which is not involved in the play of nature, Prakriti, but watches, and the very watching of the Prakriti in its primordial form causes its three principal attributes, to come into motion. And those three gunas or qualities are called sattva, rajas, and tamas. Sattva, of course, is the principle of harmony and equilibrium. Rajas is the principle of power and restless energy. And tamas is the principle of inertia, of darkness. There is nothing in the world that is constructed by Prakriti which is absent of these three gunas. One guna may dominate, they may be in balance, but all three are always present. None can be absent. The primary thing to carry away from this is that all the manifest universe in the Sankhya view is the construction of Prakriti, belongs to what is inconscient. It is not itself conscious. It seems to have consciousness in its higher realms because of the nature of the Purusha. If Purusha watches Prakriti, pays attention to her doings, then consciousness seems to be there. Consciousness, though, always resides purely, only in the Purusha station of being. So there are two beings in the Sankhya Karikas, the formalization of this great insight that the soul can stand back from nature. And they are Purusha opposed to Prakriti, soul versus nature or matter. Spirit and matter are divorced. How can you explain their connection? Advaita Vedanta comes along and says, there is only one great reality, not two, Advaita, not two, and that reality is the unchanging essence of Brahman. That only is real. What seems to be a world is a mistake that the consciousness makes. An unfortunate error, perhaps, but what it takes to be real is unreal. The great analogy that Shankara used in carrying this tradition forward from Gaudapada was that if you look in semi-darkness on the road and you see a rope, you may be frightened because you think it's a snake, and so out of fear, you determine it's a snake and you avoid it. But in reality, it was just a rope. We look at the world, we think it's moving, we think it's diverse, but really there is only an unchanging essence ever present. And we make a mistake for reasons which are attributed to Maya. That Maya cunningly stands between us and that and convinces us that the one is multiple. So Maya in Advaita has a negative role. It is the role of something that tricks you, that deceives you, that seduces you into error. So these two great traditions look at nature in a sort of pushing away force. The attitude of the Purusha must be, if you want to know the reality of your soul, to stand back from nature, because you'll get enmeshed in its activities, and therein lies imprisonment. With Advaita, if you adhere to the world, if you enjoy it, then you become a prisoner of an illusion. The goddess tradition stands forward and uses these same terms as it becomes Sanskritized, but says that this world is a play of reality. The supreme reality, the absolute, is Brahman, yes, but her essence is what indwells in the cosmos. Both spirit and matter are the same reality. They are part of the same substance. Matter, then, cannot be wholly ignorant or wholly material. It must, in some sense, also be spiritual. So the Shakti, the energy, the power of the Supreme, is the ultimate reality. So the goddess tradition is world-affirming beyond all other spiritual traditions in India. Sri Aurobindo's philosophy is also world-affirming. He never renounced the world, never accepted sannyas, but instead wanted to lift the veil of ignorance from the eyes of materialized beings so that they could see what their real essence was. So what he seeks in his integral philosophy is a reunion of spirit and matter, which is the fundamental concept, vision, and experience native to the goddess tradition. The Devi Mahatmyam, that earliest, in some ways greatest, of the goddess texts, accepts the Sankhya terminology, but reverses the order. From Prakriti itself emerge all the great goddess powers. Not from something that is merely spiritual, but out of Prakriti, as if to say, it is from spiritual nature, from a greater nature, that these cosmic deities emerge. She, the great goddess, Mahashakti, contains Purusha. Maya is softened in the goddess tradition, goes back somewhat to what the term means coming out of the Vedas, where Maya means that which measures out, as we saw in The Life Divine, which takes the infinite and gives it a compass, which finitizes what cannot be captured in this, but can be significantly represented in this, this object, which is the universe, a conscious universe, many-leveled universe, with all manner of things and beings populating it. But in reality, they are only really the one goddess. And she says so. She says, is there a second? Look, there is only me. So Maya is perplexing in its measuring out in the Devi Mahatmya, but is not necessarily evil, because she may confuse you, but she can also liberate you. How the goddess plays in these various manifestations. Sri Aurobindo will take the four great names soon, and we'll be looking at them. But in the Sri Lalita Sahasranama, which comes several hundred years after Devi Mahatmyam, we see the first, the second, and the third name describing the creation, the sovereign maintenance of, and the necessary destruction of things within the world and of the universe itself. So, Sri Mata, Sri Maharagni, Sri Matsimha Saneshwari. These establish the creation of the world through the mother power, when she stands forth as Sri Mata. Then she rules the world. And then, if she has to appear on her lion in order to strike down darkness and ignorance, she will. She will destroy if she has to. So she creates, she preserves and maintains and furthers, and if destruction is necessary, she is there to supply the blow. But all of it she does from an immense world-encompassing vision, an insight which is exact, which is penetrating. And she comes out of the fire of consciousness. Chid Agni Kunda Sambhuta. In the Devi Mahatmya, the great goddess, the Mahashakti, is never a consort. There are passages where she seems to be more associated with Vishnu than with Shiva, which is interesting because later, of course, we associate Shiva with Shakti and later Tantra. But in the Devi Mahatmya, she is free from all association. She is the supreme. And if in the thousandth name we come to know her not as the creator, the maintainer, or the destroyer, but as Lalita, she who transcends, then we have grasped an essential truth of hers, that she is always beyond all this that stations itself in the universe as part and parcel of her being. She maintains that transcendence. So in the stories depicted in the Devi Mahatmyam, we see first, coming from that transcendence, Mahakali, and then the story about Mahalakshmi, and finally the story about Mahasaraswati. So if we wanted to loosely interpret, she who is transcendent would be Maheshwari. Mahakali, Mahalakshmi, and Mahasaraswati would follow. And this is in fact the order in which Sri Aurobindo addresses these great goddess powers in his book, The Mother. So I think we can return now to the paragraphs that we can look at this evening. The Mahashakti, the Universal Mother, works out whatever is transmitted by her transcendent consciousness from the Supreme and enters into the worlds that she has made. Her presence fills and supports them with the divine spirit and the divine all-sustaining force and delight, without which they could not exist. That which we call nature or prakriti is only her most outward executive aspect. She marshals and arranges the harmony of her forces and processes, impels the operations of nature, and moves among them, secret or manifest, in all that can be seen or experienced or put into motion of life. Each of the worlds is nothing but one play of the Mahashakti of that system of worlds or universe, who is there as the cosmic soul and personality of the Transcendent Mother. Each is something that she has seen in her vision, gathered into her heart of beauty and power, and created in her Ananda. But there are many planes of her creation, many steps of the divine Shakti. at the summit of this manifestation, of which we are a part, there are worlds of infinite existence, consciousness, force, and bliss, over which the Mother stands as the unveiled eternal power. All beings there live and move in an ineffable completeness, an unalterable oneness, because she carries them safe in her arms forever. Nearer to us are the worlds of a perfect supramental creation, in which the Mother is the supramental Mahashakti, a power of divine omniscient will and omnipotent knowledge, always apparent in its unfailing works and spontaneously perfect in every process. There, all movements are the steps of the truth. There, all beings are souls and powers and bodies of the divine light. There, all experiences are seas and floods and waves of an intense and absolute ananda. But here, where we dwell, are the worlds of the ignorance, worlds of mind and life and body, separated in consciousness from their source, of which this earth is a significant center and its evolution a crucial process. This too, with all its obscurity and struggle and imperfection, is upheld by the Universal Mother. This too is impelled and guided to its secret aim by the Mahashakti. So we've seen that there are referential points between Sri Aurobindo's book and earlier texts with which he must have been familiar. He would already have, in Bengal especially, been close to the idea of the worship of the Divine Mother, because it is so dominant there. He was so intensely admirous of Sri Ramakrishna, who was himself an upasaka of the Divine Mother in the form of Kali. But in the south of India, there is too a very strong goddess tradition, and Sri Lalita Sahasranama is central to it. If you go back some centuries, you'll find hundreds and hundreds of manuscripts of this text. So Mahashakti is a term that appears in the Sri Lalita Sahasranama. It's named 217. And of course, Maha means great, Shakti means power, energy. So it is the great power. He's used the term already before to describe her. But here, he's building the idea of what is the one source of all dynamism in the cosmos. Whatever is transmitted, he says, by her transcendent consciousness from the Supreme. So here is that idea of the he and she who play in many worlds. You remember Sri Aurobindo's wonderful passage in Savitri to that. She here is the creatrix who has this vision implanted in her and executes, unrolls it. Her presence fills and supports the divine spirit. That is the reality. That is Sat. The divine all-sustaining force. That is Chit. Chit Tapas. Chit Shakti. The conscious power. And delight, ananda. So this transcendence is taking the reality of Sat Chit Ananda and translating its oneness and its infinity into various manifestation within a governable cosmos, which is the universe that we experience and populate. That which we call nature or prakriti is only her most outward executive aspect. So, there is a greater nature than the superficial nature that we see. We look at matter, we think it's inconscient. It's easy to see how one arrives at the idea that anything that comes from a material basis cannot be invested with spiritual reality, because it looks as if it's dumb, it does not speak, the rock says nothing to us. But that's simply a skeletal expression. That's not the inner truth which she is. She brings power into it, harnesses those forces, arranges them, moves nature with her conscious will towards a goal or many goals, or each individual expression of her greater being has its own goal, constellated within the enormity of what she is in her universal being. And each world that we see, this material, visible, tactile universe, is only one. There are worlds and worlds beyond this. In generalities, we speak about the world of prana, beyond the world of food, anam. Prana is the world of life, the plane of life. There are planes of mind and supramind as well, lying above our vision of things. But each of those planes has innumerable worlds within them. So how many worlds are there? We can say that there are several great steps that the divine has made, but this is untraceable to the human view. And she works in these worlds not simply as the continent or the productive agent, but she indwells them as the spiritual presence, because they cannot exist without it. All that we think is an expression has a spiritual basis, and she is that. She is the soul supporting that portion of the universe, which we call a world, which is itself a subset of a plane. And each thing she already knows in its essence, in its origination, what it will do and where it will go and what will be the result of its action. Because her vision at that level is perfect. But there are many planes, many steps. And we begin, as always, with that unknowable, but the unknowable comes into being as Satchit-Ananda, worlds of infinite existence, consciousness, force, and bliss, because consciousness can never be absent power. Force must be there if consciousness is present. And she is the eternal power which expresses them. We referred to the 700th name in Lalita Sahasranam, Satchitananda Rupani. She takes the form of Satchitananda, that infinity. In her consciousness is formed. And all beings who are part of that world, that plane, that reality, far transcendent to us, cannot wander from her. But that Satchitananda is itself established in a cohesive, collaborative, balanced expression in multitudes of what is essentially one. That is the supramental. And again, in Sri Lalita Sahasranam, there is a name for that. Name 253, Vijnana Gana Rupini, where the essence of consciousness aggregates all the jivas, all the manifested souls, which are individuated truths of that one colossal universal self, compressed together, still one, aware of each other, supportive of each other, always in harmony with each other. So from the unknowable, whatever she is in her mystery, through the realm of Satchitananda, condensed into the supramental manifestation, and then expressed from that omniscient will and knowledge into this variable beauty. That is there. Here, the divided world, where diversity forgets its oneness, and we insist on the truth that we possess against the truth that he and she possess. Separated from our source, forgetful, ignoring what we are, that is the nature of ignorance. But she too is here. She has not left. She secretly establishes the unity and enforces the harmony that will be. So I think, rather than race through this book, I hope you don't mind that we're going at a somewhat more leisurely pace than we did with The Life Divine. If it is too slow, I invite you to alert me to that with an email or a telephone call. We'll turn to Savitri. Book one, the Book of Beginnings. Canto four, the Secret Knowledge. This is the knot that ties together the stars. The two who are one are the secret of all power. The two who are one are the might and right in things. His soul, silent, supports the world and her. His acts are her commandment's registers. Happy, inert, he lies beneath her feet. His breast he offers for her cosmic dance, of which our lives are the quivering theater. And none could bear but for his strength within, yet none would leave because of his delight. His works, his thoughts have been devised by her. His being is a mirror vast of hers. Active, inspired by her, he speaks and moves. His deeds obey her heart's unspoken demands. Passive, he bears the impacts of the world as if her touches shaping his soul and life. His journey through the days is her sun march. He runs upon her roads. Hers is his course. A witness and student of her joy and dole, a partner in her evil and her good, he has consented to her passionate ways. He is driven by her sweet and dreadful force. His sanctioning name initials all her works. His silence is his signature to her deeds. In the execution of her drama's scheme, in her fancies of the moment and its mood, in the march of this obvious, ordinary world, where all is deep and strange to the eyes that see, and nature's common forms are warful wefts, she, through his witness sight and motion of might, unrolls the material of her cosmic act, her happenings that exalt and smite the soul, her force that moves, her powers that save and slay, her word that in the silence speaks to our hearts, her silence that transcends the summit word, her heights and depths to which our spirit moves, her events that weave the texture of our lives, and all by which we find or lose ourselves, things sweet and bitter, magnificent and mean, things terrible and beautiful and divine. Her empire in the cosmos she has built. He is governed by her subtle and mighty laws. His consciousness is a babe upon her knees, his being a field of her vast experiment. Her endless space is the playground of his thoughts. She binds to knowledge of the shapes of time and the creative error of limiting mind and chance that wears the rigid face of fate, and her sport of death and pain and nescience, his changed and struggling immortality. His soul is a subtle atom in a mass, his substance a material for her works. His spirit survives amid the death of things. He climbs to eternity through being's gaps. He is carried by her from night to deathless light. This grand surrender is his free will's gift, his pure transcendent force submits to hers. In the mystery of her cosmic ignorance, in the insoluble riddle of her play, a creature made of perishable stuff, in the pattern she has set for him, he moves. He thinks with her thoughts, with her trouble his bosom heaves. He seems the thing that she would have him seem. He is whatever her artist will can make. Oh, I think we'll have the chance to read that again and read it better. Namaste. Jai Ma.